So, welcome everyone to part three of practice, realization, expression, Dogen Zenji's creative path, path to creative enlightenment. Boy, you know, I have always had a problem with titles, you know. we'll get the title down by the end of this, by the end of the class, we'll have the title down. So what I'd like to do, I think, today is take up once again, you know, our study of Dogen's teaching, early teachings on Zazen. And so, therefore, it seems appropriate to start with a little Zazen. And so why don't we do that? Why don't we sit for about 10 minutes? And is everybody comfortable in their seats there? Okay. The real way circulates everywhere. How could it require practice or enlightenment? The essential teaching is fully available. How could effort be necessary? Furthermore, the entire mirror is free of dust. Why take steps to polish it? Nothing is separate from this very place. Why journey away? And yet, if you miss the mark even by a strand of hair, you are as distant as heaven from earth. If the slightest discrimination occurs, you will be lost in confusion. You could be proud of your understanding and have abundant realization, or acquire outstanding wisdom and attain the way by clarifying the mind. Still, if you are wandering about in your head, you may miss the vital path of letting your body leap. You should observe the example of Buddha Shakyamuni of the Jeta Grove, who practiced sitting up straight for 6 years, even though he was gifted with intrinsic wisdom. Still celebrated is Master Bodhidharma of the Shaolin Temple, who sat facing the wall for 9 years, although he had already received the mind seal. Ancient sages were like this. Who nowadays does not need to practice as they did? Hence, you should stop searching for phrases and chasing after words. Take the backward step and turn the light inward. Your body-mind of itself will drop off, and your original face will appear. If you want to attain just this, immediately practice just this. So, thank you all for coming. I think today what I'd like to do is go a little further with our study of Fukan Zazengi, which we started last week. For those of you who weren't here, that's no problem at all. You'll jump in to wherever we are. But I'd like to start with a redaction, or a clarification, or a re-edit of a few things from last week's class. This is in the great tradition of Dogen Zenji, who is constantly re-editing his work. So I'm going to take that as an example. Last week we studied the Fukan Zazengi, which is a text written by Dogen Zenji, and it's translated in various different ways, but recommending Zazen to all people is one of the ways. And in my introduction to the text, I said that the Fukan Zazengi was Dogen's first piece of writing after he got back from China in 1227. Okay. And so this was his first attempt to teach the Zazen that he had learned in China from his Chinese Zen teacher, his esteemed and beloved Chinese Zen teacher, whose name was Lu Jing or Ju Qing, or there are many ways, once again, of pronouncing his name. So this was, you know, he had learned this Zazen in China, and he had come back at the age of 27 to teach this Zazen to the people of Japan. And this is the traditional story of the Fukan Zazengi, you know, that this was a text that he wrote to introduce this new practice to Japan. And it's a story that's been sort of passed down through the centuries. And so this is the point number one of the redaction. Actually, things are not quite as simple as they seem. There are, in fact, serious doubts about the dates of composition of the Fukan Zazengi. And scholars have written tomes about this, which I won't go into in great detail. However, I can give you a reading list if you're interested. The version of the Fukan Zazengi that we've been reading, that we read, and that we chant during services, is a version known as the popular version. But it seems that Dogen may not have written it in 1227. After all, there's another version of the Fukan Zazengi, and it's called the Tempukubon, which simply refers to the period during which it was written, the Tempuku period. This was actually an autographed and dated version of the Fukan Zazengi, and the date was 1233. It seems now that this was the original, the original draft of the Fukan Zazengi, and that the version that we use, you know, the popular version that we use and that we've been studying, was actually written later, right? Was a rewrite of the version that was written in 1233. So in other words, it seems likely that it was written more than a decade after Dogen got back from China. So all of our, you know, our speculation about, you know, sort of Dogen's youthful zeal, you know, to bring the teachings from China, these precious teachings from China, back to the people of Japan, is kind of called into question. And what we read as youthful zeal might in fact be sort of middle-aged nostalgia, you know, of youthful zeal, right? Dogen looking back and you know, and remembering, you know, those you know, the halcyon days, right? This is interesting to me because, you know, I'm very interested in time, and I'm interested in the way that time obscures story, you know, and also time generates story too. It creates stories, right? Because we, you know, as we remember the past, every time we remember the past, we are creating new stories, as we all know, right? I mean, memory is extremely creative and unreliable, and time has this way of obscuring itself. You know, as time passes, it obscures, it erases its traces. So that's redaction number one. Also, last week, I talked about Dogen's great question, you know, the great doubt that arose in his mind when he was a young monk studying at and in training at Mount Hiei, which was the Tendai monastery. Tendai being, the powerful school or lineage of Buddhism in Japan at the time. And so last week I was talking about how, you know, at the age of 12, he was ordained at Tendai Buddhist Monastery on Mount Hiei, and he was doing strict monastic practice and training there and studying the sutras. And one of the doctrines that he learned about was the Tendai doctrine of Hongaku, which means original enlightenment. Okay, in other words, all living and non-living beings have Buddha nature, right? In their very existence, and therefore are all enlightened Buddhas. And so this teaching of Hongaku raised a doubt in Dogen's mind. You know, why, if we're all already enlightened Buddhas, do we need to make all of this effort to practice, right? And last week I pointed out that Dogen was precocious and smart, and he was a teenager. And I said that anyone who knows teenagers can completely understand this question. Like, you know, hello, you know, if I'm already enlightened, why do I have to practice, right? And I was thinking about this afterwards, and I was thinking about, you know, how I was kind of playing around with this idea of Dogen as being a kind of smartass, you know, contrarian teenager. And I was kind of inflecting the story in order to give it a little bit more punch, right? And it might be true that, in fact, Dogen was a smart-ass contrarian teenager. You know, we don't know. But it might also be true that he was, you know, completely earnest and sincere and bothered by this seeming contradiction, you know, simply because it didn't make sense to him. So, you know, both of these are possible. Then, after that, the story goes on that, Dogen, young Dogen, couldn't get an answer from the, you know, from his teachers in the Tendai school. And so he left Mount Hiei and started traveling around to other Zen temples in Japan, and he practiced with Rinzai Zen teachers, you know, which is a different school from Soto Zen. And he was searching for a teacher who could help him resolve this great doubt, this great question. And finally, he went to Japan, where after many travails and lengthy quest that sort of led him hither and yon, you know, in China, he finally met Rujing, his revered teacher. And Rujing, you know, accepted him like a son. He wrote a respectful letter to Rujing, and Rujing, you know, invited him to his private chambers and said, you know, you can come anytime, day or night, to visit me, and you don't even have to put on your robe. You can just come informally, and you will be like a son to me. And, you know, through this relationship, then Rujing taught Dogen the art of shikantaza, of just sitting. And this led to Dogen's great breakthrough and his enlightenment, his dropping off of body and mind, and resolved his doubts about practice and enlightenment, and ultimately led to the establishment of the Soto Zen school, okay, which is what we practice. So this is the traditional story that's still told about Dogen's life. And this is redaction number 3. It's likely that it isn't entirely true. Okay? It's not that it's not true, okay? But again, you know, there are scholarly tomes calling into question Dogen's experiences in China and doubting, you know, these details about the relationship with Rujing, and suggesting that over time, you know, the narrative arc of Dogen's life has been, you know, quite radically embellished, you know, even to the point of fiction. So I'm going to read you a little description of Dogen's breakthrough, his moment of enlightenment. And this is from the Denkoroku, which is, in English, it's the Transmission of the Lamp, written by Keizan Jokin in the year 1300. So Dogen died in 1253, and so this was less than 50 years after Dogen's death. And this is the Shasta Abbey translation for anybody who cares about these things. In Japanese, Rujing, Dogen's Chinese teacher, his Japanese name is Tendo Nojo. So you'll hear this. Okay. Dogen trained under Tendo Nojo. Once, during late night meditation, Nyojo told the assembly, "To practice meditation is indeed to drop off body and mind." Upon hearing this, Dogen suddenly had a great awakening to his true self. He arose immediately and went to the abbot's quarters and offered incense. Nyojo asked him, "Why are you making an incense offering?" Dogen replied, "Body and mind have dropped off." Nyojo said, "Body and mind have dropped off the dropping off of body and mind." Dogen said, "This is a transitory ability, Reverend Monk. Pray do not give me your seal arbitrarily." Nyojo said, "I'm not giving you my seal arbitrarily." Dogen said, "What is that which does not give the seal arbitrarily?" Nyojo replied, "That which drops off body and mind." Dogen bowed in respect. Nyojo said, "The dropping off has dropped off." And then there's a little addition to this story, which is really quite nice. Nyojo's jisha, or his attendant, who was Chinese, then said, "For a foreigner to find such a state is truly no trifling matter." Nyojo said, "Among those here, how many are up to a thump on the head?" Having let go and dropped off body and mind, he is mild-mannered, yet how the thunder roars. So, this dialogue to me sounds pretty fictional, okay? But it's impressive, right? I mean, it's an impressive scene, you know, how the thunder roars. And the Denkoroku, the transmission of the lamp, and also the Kenzeki, which I also quoted last week, the Kenzeki being the biography of Dogen that was written by the 14th abbot of Eheiji, so 200 years after Dogen's death. These kinds of biographies include all sorts of embellishments that appear to nudge the narrative arc of Dogen's story into a shape that starts to resemble Siddhartha's. Right, which we talked about in the first class, including a scene where the young Dogen, just as he was about to have his coming of age ceremony, sneaks out of his father's house and goes and visits a monk, you know, at the base of Mount Hiei. And these accounts sort of, you know, contain an impressive array of miracles as well. At the moment of Dogen's birth, for example, a voice in the sky predicted his future greatness. By the age of 3, he'd read all of the collective poems of the Chinese poet Li Qiao. By the time he was 8, he had read the entire Abhidhamma Khoso. By the time he was 17, he'd read the entire Buddhist canon twice over. During his quest in China, he overcomes a wild tiger. when he lectures later at Eheiji, the monastery that he founded, flowers fall from the sky on the entire assembly, and the air fills with a marvelous fragrance, and mysterious bells are heard to chime. So, I point this out because it tells us something about the power of story and the power of this quest narrative that we talked about in the first class, and also about the appeal of, well, magical realism, but also, you know, this kind of clean narrative arc. And it also tells us something about the unreliable nature of stories and teachers who make stuff up and inflect stuff in a way to give them more impact. Right. And not just teachers who happen to be novelists, but all teachers. Right. and finally, it tells us something about the power of hagiography, you know, and religious institutions that shape what we think of as history. You know, these are the founding stories of the Soto Zen lineage, which was trying to establish itself, you know, in opposition to and in the face of serious political challenges from the Tendai lineage, and also from other sects of Buddhism. So, you know, maybe given that, given the political context, they needed a few miracles, right? And it's also a good reminder to question creativity. And to question creative expression. What is creativity? What motivates creativity? What its uses are. But I would also suggest that, just because it's fiction, or it's fictional, or it's fictional-ish, does it mean that it's less true? And once again, as a novelist, I'd argue that these stories are differently true. It's not an either or, it's not an either or choice here. It's more of a both and. These stories are differently true, and like all great religious texts, we can look at them as maps or metaphors. And if they give us some inspiration and some encouragement to make more effort, then that's great too. In Fukan Zazenki, Dogen says, "Ancient sages were like this. Who nowadays does not need to practice as they did? Hence, you should stop searching for phrases and chasing after words. Take the backward step and turn the light inward. Your body-mind of itself will drop off, and your original face will appear. If you want to attain just this, immediately practice just this." And in the end, all of this scholarly quibbling, this searching after words and phrases, is fascinating to me because it highlights this issue of textual instability, not knowing, uncertainty. These old teachings and stories get passed down through time, and they survive wars and famines and fires and floods, and they get copied and recopied and translated and mistranslated and passed down, sort of body to body, hand to hand, mouth to ear. And so in a way, these teachings are time beings too. They live and they grow and they change in time as we invest them with our own personal and political and cultural inflections. And certainly we're in the midst of a huge change in the evolution of these texts now, I think, as they move over into English, right? And I don't think it's too fanciful to turn this idea around and say that, as the teachings express themselves through us, they are expressing their own kind of creativity as well. The Dharma is, by its nature, creative, and it expresses its creativity through each of us, through our separate selves, our separate minds, our separate bodies, but also collectively as well. And so here, I go back to that passage that I keep quoting. I can't seem to get past this passage from Genjo Koan. To study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be actualized by the myriad things. When actualized by the myriad things, the body and mind of the self and the body and mind of others drop away. No trace of realization remains, and we express this ungraspable trace endlessly. So that's my redaction of last week's class. And now we barely have time for this week's class. So, oh dear. however, last week, we began to scratch the surface of Fukan Zazengi. And today what I'd like to do is to make a little bit more effort and to dig more deeply into the text and try to tease out some of the more embedded meanings. As I said, there's this great temporal and cultural divide that separates us in 2014 from Dogen in 1227 or 1233 or 1240, whatever. And so what I'd like to do is kind of try to plunge into that great divide with you and try to narrow that gap a little bit. And I think what I'd like to do too is to investigate some of the textual instability that gets compounded when a text undergoes translation. And so today what I'd like to do is to work with two different translations of Fukan Zazengi, the Kaz Tanahashi version, which I passed out last week, and I have extra copies of that as well. And then the translation that's in our chant books, which is the one that's used in most of the North American Soto Zen temples and monasteries, I think, right? And I'm not sure exactly. It's either the Waddell translation or the, anyway, it's a different translation. And so I think the way I'd like to do this is to ask you to break into groups again, maybe groups of four this time. And we'll pass out the chant books. And then I'd like to ask you to take turns reading sections of the chant book version, okay, to each other and listening. And hopefully most of you will have, or some of you anyway, will have the Ta-Nehisi version too. And to just, you know, as you're listening or as you're reading, just kind of make note of anything that you don't understand, anything that you think is interesting, anything that you'd like to bring up for discussion, okay? And especially pay attention to words and references that seem odd or seem, you know, like maybe there's something more there, you know, that things that you don't understand or have questions about. And also, since we are doing two different translations, pay attention too to your preferences. Okay, which ones you like better? Because that's always interesting, I think. And when we approach this, maybe try to approach it with the mind of not knowing. Okay, so even if you think you might know something about, you know, a reference, but you're not certain, go ahead and make a note of that. Okay, and then when we all come back together into the large group, what I'd like to do is just ask people to share their notes and their questions, and then together somehow we'll help each other try to figure out, you know, and sort of how to interpret what it is that Dogen's talking about. And I think maybe what we should do too is pass out pads so that everyone has a pad and you can make notes as you're listening as well. So why don't we go ahead and pass things out, and then we'll take it from there. What I'd like to suggest that you do is take turns. You know, you can do it paragraph by paragraph, and not to discuss it right away, but just to, you know, just to read it to, you know, to the group. And as you're reading, as you're listening, to make notes of any phrases or, you know, words that you don't understand that you'd like to bring up for discussion later. And then just, you know, so that each person has a chance to read once or twice, and you just kind of go around in the circle.
So you want us to have a little pause after each paragraph for people to first
take? Yeah, that might be good. That might be good. To read a paragraph and then pause briefly just to take a few notes, and then the next person go.
Do you read one from each one?
No. Just read the one in the chant book. Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, just read the one in the chant book. But, you know, if you'd like to, you know, sort of refer back to the Ta-Nehisi translation, then that's what that's for. Yeah, okay. All right. So we'll spend as long as it takes. Okay, so I do understand the sort of absurdity of doing this kind of, you know, granular textual parsing of a teacher who's telling us not to do that, right? I do understand that this is absurd.
It's fun.
Exactly, it's fun. But exactly, and you know, I mean, in a way, this was a little bit of an self-indulgence because I just, you know, as somebody who works with words, I love doing this. I love looking at translations. I love, you know, sort of testing the resonances of you know, words and phrases, and you know, and then, you know, it's true that if you think about it, you're not going to really understand it, but somehow working with language like this, and then, you know, little bits of it will surface in your zazen. It kind of goes into your body somehow, and it comes back to you, and, you know, you don't quite know how, and then suddenly you'll be, you know, something will just kind of click, and you know, I think that's the power of you know, of this, is that the words and phrases do kind of seep and permeate into your body and into your sitting experience. So that was one reason why I wanted to try this. The other reason was because, as I overheard someone saying in the discussion, I've never liked Fukan Zazenge. No, I'm not naming names. I'm not naming names. But, you know, but the thing is that, you know, we chant this. You know, we chant this in our services sometime. And I've also had that feeling of like, really, Fukan Sazengi, we're chanting that whole thing?
Right before lunch?
Yeah, right, exactly, right. And we're probably going to be chanting it at Loon Lake, you know? I would imagine.
No, actually, we nixed it last year.
Oh, no! You should have told me. I could have spared everybody.
We reinstated it, though, just okay.
For you. Thank you.
Yeah, we could do the cause version. But so anyway, I have had feelings like that of resistance to the Fukan Zazengi. But at the same time, when I actually started to study it and look at the different translations, I suddenly had a new appreciation for it. And so I wanted to share that. I guess that's really the reason why, you know. And then the other thing, too, I think, is that this is, in a way, Dogen's most succinct and in a way poetic expression of this very, very fundamental teaching. I had the idea of maybe doing some longer fascicles that are much more complicated, but then I kept coming back to the Fukan Zazengi because it is so succinct, and it's so well, I mean, he worked on it for a really long time, right? He edited it and re-edited it, and it's a kind of a beautiful expression, I think, of this particular teaching. So and there's a lot to it. So what I'd like to do now, I think, is just to invite people to call out, you know, some of the sections that you've marked, and then kind of open it up for discussion, and maybe together we can kind of help each other sort of parse this a little bit. And you know, I guess the other thing I'm curious about is your thoughts about the translation, the two translations as well. I have more translations too, if you're curious. But anyway, let's just sort of start. What was that?
This is slow now.
let's start at the, you know, sort of, you know, just whatever sort of pops to mind. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, it's just, I work in translation from Chinese, so yeah. I look at this. The second one is so much more inviting, and the flow is so much more vivid, and I found it much more...
The Ta-Nehisi version.
I found it much easier to appreciate.
Yeah, and I think that's... when I found that version too, I was surprised because I was so used to chanting the other one, and it was just very... It felt very light and refreshing to me, and so that was... Yeah.
Musical.
Yeah, musical, yeah. Yeah.
I think the first one is an example of what happens with translation by committee.
Right. Yeah.
I appreciated the metaphor in the second one in particular, and some of the leaps that the metaphor took, because it just let me decide what my impressions were, and I liked that.
Nice.
I found that was lost a bit in the other one.
Yeah. Interesting.
One thing I've always appreciated about Fukan Zazengi is the practicality and the physicality of it. You know, it's not just about theoretical, metaphysical Zen philosophy. It's very much about here, you're grounded in the body now, and this is how you do it. And that was my first kind of clicking with Fukan Zazengi, actually, was he's got some practical advice here about closing my mouth and putting my tongue against the front roof of my mouth. What does that mean? So it's very kind of practical as well.
Yeah.
Very unlike the other sutras.
Yeah, and I was also thinking about, you know, this, you know, the instruction, think not thinking. How do you think not thinking, non-thinking, or there's many other ways of, but really that's a instruction to, you know, to move out of the, you know, to move out of the mind into the body.
Yeah.
Right. So that you know is kind of there as well. Yeah.
Do you have some examples from other translations of exactly the wording of think not?
Yes. Yeah. I happen to have that. Wait, what did I do? I just happen to have that. Kay, I have that.
Because Kaz chooses to say beyond.
Yes, Kaz chooses to say.
I think he's being a bit interpretive there, and that the Japanese is not beyond, but two different ways of saying not or no.
Well, what's interesting is that actually Okumura...
What's he say?
Beyond thinking. Think. He says, think of not thinking. How do you think of not thinking beyond thinking?
Beyond thinking.
Yeah. And the other version is non-thinking, right? Think of not thinking. How do you think of not thinking? Non-thinking. The Nishijima translation, there's another Japanese translator who translates it. This is interesting. He translates it as a dialogue, okay? Think about this concrete state beyond thinking. That's one person. And then the next person, how can the state beyond thinking be thought about? ? And then, it is different from thinking. Okay, so once again, think about this concrete state beyond thinking. How can the state beyond thinking be thought about? It is different from thinking. Okay, and that, I think, points to the fact that this is actually, that think not thinking is part of a koan, right? That and so this is just a kind of a Dogen's shorthand reference to this dialogue that is in the classical koan literature, and so in a way the actually fleshing it out as a dialogue, as in that last translation, is pointing back to the fact that this comes from this is in a way Fukan Zazengi is pulling a lot of references from classical literature. It's filled with references from classical literature, and this is one of them. So. Any other things that kind of pop to mind? Yeah. Questions about?
In causes, he says, in the middle of the second paragraph, the slightest discrimination is presumable. You would be proud of your understanding and have abundant realization, or acquire outstanding wisdom and attain the way by clarifying the mind. But in the book, it's like way more negative. Suppose one gains pride of understanding and inflates one's own enlightenment, glimpsing the wisdom that runs through all things, attaining the way and clarifying the mind, raising an aspiration to escalate the very sky. Very different tone.
Yeah, very different tone. Yeah, very different tone. Yeah. And I've always hated that word escalade.
Me too.
Yeah.
Let's just all get it all out on the table here.
That's what I think.
What?
It's a kind of car.
Yeah,
it's
a kind of
car.
An Escalade.
Yeah, shade of one.
It's a kind of car. That's great.
I had it even before those.
So, we don't have another one handy of that, do we?
Let's see. Hang on. Uh-oh. I do, and I didn't make it. Okay, so just let's. I did not make this. Somebody else, some other completionist made it, not me.
Second paragraph.
Yeah, this is a little. Sorry, it's going to take me a minute.
Like you'd have to consult, a panel of Japanese Dogen scholars to see how they each would weigh in on just how critical that tone should be.
Here's one. For example, some people are proud of their understanding and think that they are richly endowed with the Buddha's wisdom. They think that they have attained the way, illuminated their minds, and gained the power to touch the heavens. They imagine that they are wandering about in the realm of enlightenment, but in fact, they have almost lost the absolute way, which is beyond enlightenment itself. Okay, so that's one. Here's another. We can still hear rumors of the 9 years... Oh, is that right? No, hang on. Here we go. Proud of our understanding and richly endowed with realization, we obtain special states of insight. We attain the truth, we clarify the mind. We acquire the zeal that pierces the sky. We ramble through remote intellectual spheres, going in with the head. That's interesting. Yeah. Yeah. Even if you are proud of your understanding, are enlightened, even if you are proud of your understanding, are enlightened in abundance and obtain the power of wisdom to glimpse the ground of Buddhahood. Even if you gain the way, clarify the mind, resolve to pierce the heaven that is only strolling on the border of the Buddha way, you are still almost always lacking in the vivid path of emancipation. Mm-hmm. No, that's Okumura again.
Yeah, that's
interesting.
So there really is a negative tone to that.
You know, hearing a series of them like that, you start to almost do a sort of osmotic kind of absorption of the basic components of the passage.
Yeah.
And you can let go of the particular wording, mm-hmm. right? And kind of, you know, because there's not one of them that's definitive.
Yeah, exactly.
We can like one particularly or not. Yeah.
And I'm sure that preference, too, will, you know, changes over time, you know. Yeah.
Can you comment on causes, that phrase he says, you may miss the vital path of letting your body leap. Where does that come?
We were just, Kate and I were just regretting the fact that we don't have the Japanese here.
I wish I'd brought it for this. I can barely stand up after Zazen. Never mind.
I don't have a note on that.
We can come back to you next week. But that's a big difference between letting your body leap and... Where is the way of
total emancipation?
But it does remind me of the sort of beyond the intellectual approach to it. Mm-hmm. If you're actualizing in your body, if you're just doing what's beyond thinking, your body just leaps because that's what bodies do.
Yeah.
Except maybe after you've been sitting zazen.
There's the 100-foot pole too. What do you do when you get to the top of the 100-foot pole?
In the first paragraph, it's and cause. It's the entire mirror is free of cause.
Yeah.
And the other one, it's the whole body is far beyond the world's dust. So it's almost like you could call it the body or the mirror.
That's, you know, that's a reference to the story about the sixth patriarch, the sixth ancestor, right? And the verse competition that the fifth patriarch asked his disciples to write. You know, write a verse that that expresses their understanding, right? And so one of his chief disciple wrote a verse that went something like, "This body is the Bodhi tree. The mind, like a bright mirror on a stand, constantly strive to brush it clean. Do not allow dust to collect." So that was the sort of orthodox, sort of understanding of, you know, of effort, right, of practice and effort. And then his other student, Huainang, responded with this verse, basically, Bodhi is not a tree, neither does the mind mirror have a stand. From the first, there is not a single thing, so where can dust collect? Right? And so this was the, you know, this was the you know, the alternative understanding. And the second guy, right.
He had to go hide out for how many years, right? Because he was an illiterate woodcutter, right? Yeah. He had just shown up in time for this competition.
Yeah. And in fact, he couldn't even, apparently, I mean, the story goes...
Pounding rice in the kitchen for several years after he turned up.
I'd been working for a while first.
In the kitchen and doing,
But then instead of being able to receive transmission right away, he had to kind of go hide out because they wouldn't have accepted him. Yeah. Yeah, so his teacher, fifth patriarch, said.
said, so, you're my true Dharma heir, but
you have to leave.
You have to leave because you're not going to survive if you stay, you know, if you stay here. Yeah.
As someone who, you know, sometimes indulges in creative writing, one thing also of me, like if I, when I'm sitting, if something comes to mind after 10 minutes, that's often a sentence pops in my head or an idea, that's often the end of my sitting. So just wondering what you personally make of this. So hence you should stop searching for phrases and chasing after words. Are you able to, when you say, are you able to totally put your project aside, or does it get interrupted? Does it come up during the sitting?
Well, I am constantly, yes. I mean, I as somebody who works in words, I'm always, you know, ideas are constantly coming. They rise, especially when I'm in the middle of a project. And, it used to be that I was, I found that very disruptive, especially when I was first starting to sit. I found it very disruptive and have been known to, sit with a little piece of paper and a pen next to me, now, mind you, I don't do that anymore. No, I'm just kidding. At first, because it was so disruptive, and actually, I think it was Norman who's, or somebody, suggested that I do that. If it was constantly bothering me, the best way was just to make a note and then be able to really put it aside. But little by little, it stopped bothering me as much, and now I just have more of a sense that if something, if an idea comes up, and if it's important, then I'll remember it. But that was not my experience at the beginning. At first I was, I was very paranoid about forgetting things, and it was also at a time when I was taking care of my mom who had Alzheimer's, so forgetting was a big issue in my mind, right? And so that's when that really, that became an issue. But now now it's kind of receded. Now maybe it's just that I forget so completely that it doesn't sort of linger and bother me anymore, and I can have faith that will happen.
So one of the things that I'm most interested in, I can't help but always or often look at where Soto Zen in particular, but and Buddhism in general, has dropped away from or separated from the sutras and the teachings of the yogis, because that's sort of my practice and my lineage, and my teacher is a Zen Buddhist, but he's also a yogi, and so in that respect, we're looking at it together in those ways. And the Buddha, from my understanding, himself also, lived in a time when, in India, when yoga and yogis were Brahmins, so it was only the elites that were practicing and were able to, and then also went off into the forests. And so then, after the Buddha was enlightened and offered his teachings, part of it was to not be away from, to be in the forest and away from society, but to be part of. And I'm just sort of giving this a little bit of background, only because I don't want to just throw this out there, but I think just to touch on what we were talking about earlier of like how can the body leap and how can we sit, and I think, my teacher says literally and often jokingly that yogis need meditation and meditators need yoga. And I'm biased because I think the two are married so beautifully together, and I'm not on a mission to like try and make you all do yoga with me or anything, but I think that the fact is that the two do work so well, and a lot of people do practice that in order for the, and it is said that one does yoga in order to prepare the body to for sitting.
Yeah.
So I wonder, I'm curious where that, at what point did various teachers and scholars decide that there wasn't a need to continue to look at that, and how the two became so separate from each other. I know it's a bigger, I'm just throwing it out there, but it's because it comes up, and I hear a lot of times in
in Sangha communities where people are, and I'm not saying it as a, you know, that there's a complaint or whatnot, but there's this, you know, sitting is hard on the body. And then with this movement in now that like yoga is so popular and everything, and that, but it's gotten so far away from Patanjali's Yoga Sutras and the ethics of practice, which is so absolutely similar to the Buddha's teachings of the Four Noble Truths. I mean, if you look at them, they're the comparison between those and then of the Ashtanga piece around the ethics of nonviolence and whatnot, and it's interesting to me that there isn't more crossover happening over time, and perhaps that will come.
I mean, I you know,
I think it's happening here in the West.
I think it's happening here in the West, exactly.
And where those, you know, that you're not going to find anyone in a Japanese monastery doing yoga, or and where that I don't know that history through China. You know, there was the Taoist influence, and there was certainly Taoist yogic practice. There were Taoist yogic practices that at some point probably were connected, but you know, I don't know. But obviously, in the West, there's cross pollinization, so you do find people teaching both Buddhist meditation and yoga, or at least in conjunction with.
Right.
Yeah.
But I think if not, had a very strong consciousness of the body. Maybe they didn't do yoga exercises, but there's always been a really strong emphasis on posture and realization through the body and through the breath. So,
Well, and that's what I was thinking. There's other, it's not like so latched together, but the, you know, the martial arts and the archery and the body movement things, I think, are incorporated into lifestyle or whatever. So maybe they're not totally, but I think that relationship is there, just maybe not as...
In fact, it's, in Japanese culture, it's very there in terms of practices that are infused with... with Zen practice that are embodied practices. You know, tea ceremony is an embodied practice.
Yes.
Calligraphy is an embodied practice. And you could say the martial arts are sort of, depending how they're taught. But yoga as, you know, that tradition kind of didn't make it to Japan historically. Very, in that intact way.
In fact, as you were talking just before, I was thinking about how Norman speaks of his teachers who came and founded San Francisco? The Zen Center. There was this, the initial founders, he says at one point that he had this dream of it, of Zen going to North America to start anew, in that it would have a freshness to it that wouldn't be quite so rigid, and that there's still this hope for it to continue to go full circle back to Japan in a new way.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's certainly been known to happen in other areas.
They're actually sending young Japanese monks over to practice at American centers.
And I think that, I mean, this is one of the, you know, once again, that this idea of these teachings being alive, you know, and these teachings being, you know, sort of expressing themselves through us, you know, and certainly, you know, our cultural inflections will change how these teachings are conveyed and passed along, and so I'm sure, you know, I'm sure that will happen. I mean, that's really the creative expression too, isn't it? It's where the sort of the creativity arises. At Upaya this summer, we had yoga, wonderful yoga classes, incorporated into the day, and certainly, you know, in our very sedentary North American, you know, computer culture, you know, we need that, you know. I am very supportive of that. So anybody else? We need to kind of wrap things up, but anybody have any last burning questions about references in the text? One of the things that I guess I'll say is that I love that all of the translations refer to Zazen as an art. And this is the essential art of Zazen, and I just think that's wonderful. That's a wonderful line to remember, that it's a kind of an art form. Anybody else have any? I mean, there's...
Just a comment. I think it's really helpful for me to kind of hear and realize that there's a lot of references to other texts that they assume you already know, but when you're coming out of fresh, it's like, this isn't making a lot of sense.
Yes. I mean, we once again, you know, and I promise we won't do this next week, but if you wanted to, no. there are many, many references, you know, embedded references, and maybe what I'll do is I'll share this document that I have, and I'll put it online, and that way you can read the notes yourself. They have, so many of these just very light, one-line, two-line references refer to Chinese poems or refer to koans or refer to, to other literature. I mean, the references to groping the elephant and the true dragon and, all of these are references to, stories. That come before, and this is once again, I have to say, this is the thing that appeals to me so much about this, because it's I think as a writer, I'm very aware of this, that I that everything I write is a conversation that I'm having with the writers who I've read. Right, and so it's a conversation that I've had with literature that's gone before, and that's, I think, where creativity comes from, is that kind of conversation, and so when when you read a text like Fukan Zazengi, and can take a word or a phrase and unpack it and realize that there's this whole story, behind it. That to me is a kind of a magical, it's kind of magical. It's like, oh gosh, this is going to be so terrible. It's like a hyperlink. and you touch, groping for the elephant, and, it expands into this whole, a whole story of its own, which I'm sure will have hyperlinks in it, that you touch, and then, what I mean? So it's this beautiful sort of, this outgrowth, constantly things growing from its, from things that have gone before, and it's really lovely. Good. That was I hope you enjoyed that a little bit anyway. and let's see. I have a suggestion, another home practice suggestion. Okay. So we're halfway through our class and the practice period now. And I'd like to suggest that during this week, during your home practice, your creative practice at home, and also your Zen practice at home, that you think about effort. Okay, I'd like to invite you to think about effort. Last week, we had two of our Sangha members from our sister Sangha members from Bellingham come up, and Jeff McKenna commented in our discussion afterwards that he was struck by the earnestness of the tone of Fukan Zazengi, and by what he felt was Dogen's sort of heartfelt and earnest desire to an urgent desire to kind of pass these teachings on to the Japanese people, and I think he's right. That's there. But another sort of question that came up, was related to this, is this idea of effort, and it's kind of a paradox at the heart of Fukan Zazengi. Why is effort necessary if the teaching is freely available? Once again, why polish the mirror if it's already free of dust? Why search for an answer if you already have it? So these reflect the original, Dogen's original question, You know, why practice if you're already enlightened? And so there's a little bit of a paradox there. You know, on one hand, he's exhorting us to, you know, to make this tremendous effort, you know, citing, you know, Shakyamuni and Bodhidharma and 6 years of sitting and 9 years of facing a wall, you know. But on the other hand, he's telling us to stop trying so hard. You know, to stop, you know, stop searching for words and phrases, you know, stop conscious endeavor and analytic, you know, don't try to become a Buddha, right? And then, you know, on one hand, he gives us very, very precise instructions about exactly where and how to sit and how to align our body and on, you know, on our mind. And then on the other hand, he's telling us to, you know, take the backward step to practice just this, you know, that Zazen is all about enjoyment and ease and bliss, right? And if we relax, you know, the true Dharma will emerge, you know, of itself, right? And then...
yeah.
No? Is that working for you? And then, you know, in another essay that a shorter version of Fukan Zazengi, it's called Zazengi, Rules for Zazen, he writes, you know, and many of you will know this, mindful of the passing time, engage yourself in Zazen as though saving your head from fire, right? So that's a lot of effort, right? You know, when time is passing, there's this real urgency to save your head from fire. And so you not only need to make an effort, but you need to make a supreme effort, and you need to do it now, you know? But, you know, on the other hand, Zazen is the Dharma gate of enjoyment and ease and, you know, repose and bliss and, you know. And I think, you know, Eric said something about, he said, an invitation by Dogen seems to be a seduction and an admonition, right? And that's lovely. You know, that's also a kind of a, you know, points to the paradox, you know, and to this kind of dualistic sense of contradiction, you know. So I guess what I'm asking you to think about is, you know, what's your own relationship to this paradox? What's your own relationship to effort? You know, and maybe if you feel that you are not making enough of an effort, try to turn up the fire, you know, turn up the heat. Or if you feel that you're trying too hard, you know? Oh, I... You know, dial it down a little bit and try it and see what it feels like. Just as an experiment. It's a thought experiment, you know. Just try, you know, try adjusting your...
Body experiment.
It's a body experiment, right. It's a body experiment and a yeah. So, you know, just play with that. Play with that. You know, if you kind of feel like, oh, I'm slacking off a little bit, you know, turn up the heat and see what it feels like. Just a little bit, not too much. You know, we're sort of, you know, it is experiments in the middle way here. So, and then next week I'd like to talk about this, and also I'd like to, you know, sort of open it up for more of a discussion about what kind of creative practice we've been doing, and really talk about this idea of effort. So, good. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
So if people could put their seats, then I'll go.